Hey everyone, it's Tyla Abercrombie, and you are now listening to the Actors Lounge. Get ready.
Hey guys, and welcome back to an all new episode of the Actors Lounge. I'm your host, Melanie Victor, and today we have with us a very special guest. Please welcome to the show, actor, writer, and director, Tyla Abercrombie. Hi, Tyla. How's it going?
Hi. It's wonderful, Mel. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you here. So first thing I usually like to start off with is, you know, I like to get the backstory and just ask people, like, you know, how this journey started for you. Like, where did acting and performing, like, what part of your life did that come into? Was it early on or was it something that happened later in life?
Well, that's a good question, and it's actually a combination of both. Always as a young girl, I was, you know, a kid, like 6, 7, 8, 9. I was always drawn to, you know, poetry and writing and creating, and I'd get teased a lot by, you know, my siblings, and my father used to say things like, "Stop acting like a cartoon." So I was always drawn into, and that might sound cruel, but, you know, it wasn't. It wasn't meant to be cruel.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's actually like a compliment for us.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was just, it just meant I had a lot of energy, and I was just a bit much, you know. And so, but I didn't know anything about how to become an actor. You know what I mean? I loved watching movies. Mm-hmm. I watched classic movies with my mom and things like that. And so there was always something there that drew me to what I now know as the arts. But coming from a family of people who, you know, they didn't do this type of thing. They were just working class people trying to survive. There was no guiding me in any direction towards anything in particular, but definitely not the arts. Mm-hmm. So that's why it came later, after I had gone to high school and was in college, and I had seen, you know, the Alvin Ailey dancers as a kid and just wanted to know, how can I make magic like that? And now here I am, you know, a young adult, and I get to college. I think I'm going to study accounting, and I realize, like, if I got to, you know, pay for this, I'm going to switch to what I want. And then that took me into taking theater and pursuing it full time, you know, well, not full time, but part time at that point. And here I am today.
Wow. And are you originally from Chicago? Do I have that right?
You do have that correct. I was born and raised on the west side of Chicago in the Austin community.
Okay. Okay. And mm-hmm. I think it's so cool that you're from Chicago and you're on the Shy. I know. I'm like, that is like the perfect scenario situation, especially for an actor, you know, just where you're from and then to be on a show that represents your city. I think that's really amazing.
No, I agree with you. There's certain things that you kind of want to do as an actor. And I remember, I always wanted to be on stage with the Goodman. It was like, I'm from Chicago. I should be on stage with the Goodman. My face should be up on a Goodman banner. You know what I mean? Yeah. I wanted, or marquee. I just wanted that so bad. And I remember, the first time I did get to perform at the Goodman in a play called Magnolia, directed by, Anna Shapiro from, Steppenwolf. I remember walking out on stage and, you know, after the play started, it was like, okay, it's going. And we did the play, and it, you know, it went well. And that night I went out to a cast party with, you know, friends hanging in our local kind of actor dive bar. And I remember expressing to a friend of mine, you know, it's so funny how you can't wait to be on a certain stage. And then you realize they all feel the same. And that's not a bad thing. Yeah. What that means is you give your all on every stage. Mm-hmm. And once you start talking, you forget you forget the audience, mm-hmm. and you live the moment. But I thought, oh, somehow being on the Goodman was going to be so different mentally to me. But really, it was just an accomplishment that I wanted to achieve. And I've since done it twice. So that was really good.
Wow, that's amazing. So you have a strong love for the stage, obviously. And I know, I mean, being from Chicago, that's like a big part of Chicago, right? Theater, that whole culture, right?
It is. I do have a tremendous love for the stage. And in Chicago, we have a tremendous and thriving pre-COVID, and we're going to get back to it, theater community. And what I love about our community is that I always liken us to the typical, say, Midwest hard worker, in that, you know, we're not like LA. LA doesn't really have theater, but that theater they do have is either Showcase or it's, you know, stars doing theater. Broadway, New York, of course, is everybody's waiting for that producer to be in the audience to, like, discover them. Well, in Chicago, we do theater because we love theater. You know, it's about that kind of Midwest dedication and dedication to the work, and not the sudden opportunity of being discovered or sudden opportunity of, you know, being in the perfect production, but it is literally the work. Mm-hmm. And so we have a tremendous work ethic toward theater in Chicago. We've got great experimental theater here, mm-hmm. fantastic new writers. We support new writers in Chicago. And we're a small enough community that we almost all kind of know each other or have seen each other or heard of each other in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So yeah, theater is really... And it really always trips me out when people come here, because especially people from, say, New York or L.A., they have no concept of how serious the theater is here. And they don't know that we are, even though we are number three in the theater, you know, number three theater in the world. You know, you've got London, New York, London, and Chicago. Mm-hmm. That's the order. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, you know, I was watching your reel and I saw that you had like a lot of different characters on there. Like what are the ways that you tap into a character, or how do you begin to, you know, put your spin on a role that you're playing? Like, what is your process?
Well, the first thing, when we talk about television, because TV, you know, oftentimes you don't get the whole, you know, especially if you're auditioning, you know, you don't get the whole script and you just get the size of the character. So I always believe in doing that one thing that makes you feel a little different. Like, you can read it and you pretty much know, like, everybody's going to come in and kind of do this or do that or a third. And so I try to read it and look at it like, what would make this person different, but very much the character that I'm auditioning for. And then once I am fortunate enough to get a role, what's important to me is the honesty. You know, no matter if it's comedy or drama, it's about how honest can you be, because when you're playing a role, I am playing the role, Tyler is, but the role you're playing is about being true to whoever you're portraying. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They're not, your character isn't acting. Your right. character is being honest and living their true self in the moment, moment to moment. So I think what I look for mostly is how honest can I be in this character, mm-hmm. so much so that no matter what it's about, it's relatable, you know?
Yeah, that's really good. I think the honesty, the truth, and like you said, just being unafraid to go there and be vulnerable and removing yourself or like how you would react or how you would respond, but really tapping into that character. That's really good advice.
That's really good. You said all that. I agree with all that. So that's perfect.
Well, that is good. I'm glad to know that I'm on the same page as you.
You are, very much.
So, you know, we've all been going through COVID and the pandemic. What would you say are some of the things that you learned about yourself and the industry during this time? You know, a lot of us have had to pivot, make changes, adapt. You know, how has your process been during COVID?
Wow, that's loaded. I've learned a lot. The beginning of it was I learned that I've always been very comfortable with my own company. So that was very true even when COVID started. However, by the seventh month, I was like, now I realize how much my life is engaged to theater, going to openings, doing readings, plays, you know, being around the community. And how important, I thought it was important, and I knew it was important, but of course when you have a saturation of a thing, you can be sort of indifferent to it at times and think that, you know, you're tired of it or you had enough of it, and it's not till it's totally snatched away from you that you, like, you really, really value it on a different level. And I realized that, like, that importance of how much my engagement with others is around the arts and creativity. So that was one thing I learned. Yeah. The pivot that I had to figure out is, and I think I'm still figuring it out, you know, part of my whole audition process has always been to feel very prepared for auditions and go in, and I always say, just drop the mic, which means to me, as actors, we have no control over what happens in the room. We have very much control over how we come in that room and how we leave that room, right? And so I always feel very powerful when I audition and not afraid, and just this level of fearlessness that goes into, I know what I'm doing, I'm prepared, here you go, goodbye. And so now the pivot became, we are, you know, we have to shoot ourselves, you know, on camera, we've got to edit ourselves, and we've got to, in some cases, audition with friends. Now, this is really important, and I don't want to, tell me if I'm talking too much, but this was really important. It was important to realize that I am prepared to go into an audition room and do that which I just expressed to you. Mm-hmm. There's a reader already provided, and I'm good. But now, in this world of finding a friend to read with you or whatever, I realize that I love my friends, don't get me wrong, but nobody is prepared to come in the room with you the way you come in the room. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if you called me and asked me to read with you, I'm going to be ready. When you call me, I will have printed the side. Mm. I will have highlighted the opposite character. Mm-hmm. And I'm ready to help you win this role.
Yeah.
That's because that's how I work for myself. Mm-hmm. Friends, as sweet as they may be, they don't work that way.
Right.
And so for me, it feels like they're not helping me be a stronger character, and they're not helping me push the door open wider. And so I had to really figure out how to do auditions with people who I didn't think were, you know, were not giving me their all, without like judging them because they are giving me their time, and also auditioning by myself. You know, I record a lot by myself, and so that I can get the timing that I want. So that pivot became really, really a struggle for me. And also, you know, when you're in the room with someone, you're making the impression. When you're doing it on a camera, you know, it's got to be smaller, and you're acting with the little person in the corner, maybe, if you have a Zoom partner.
Right.
And so you're not relating to anyone. You're never relating to anyone anymore. So that's really hard, I think, as an actor, to act by yourself all the time, you know?
Yeah, no, that's so true, because just, was it last Saturday, I did this, like, self-tape class for, it was on Zoom for Richard Lawson Studios, and it was, like, a lot of people that just put up their self-tapes, and who was the casting director? I can't remember her name, but I can't remember. It slipped my mind. But they were giving a lot of feedback, and it was about the readers. They were just like, you know, your reader's energy needs to match your energy. The voice needs, like, and a lot of people, they were saying, like, you know, they were saying almost like the same thing you were saying. Like, it's just, it's tough because it's a friend just helping me out, you know? And it's like,
right,
we don't have that same energy. Like, it's almost like we're trying to do the best that we can. We're all adjusting here. You know what I mean? So you touching on that is, I think a lot of people are dealing with those type of adjustments when it comes to the auditioning.
Yeah, and it's also to me, is a degree of arrogance as casting directors. It's like, we're all dealing with COVID. We're all coming in this situation where, you know, now we're opening up a little more, whatever, and some of the places we might go, like Vagabond, and record our stuff is available. But overall, people couldn't even come in your house. So if you're a person that live alone, you know, you're like, and you invite a friend over, they're like, well, you know, I don't want to expose myself. I got kids, or I got a, you know, family, whatever. And so they're doing the best they can. They're on Zoom. You've got to make sure you're worried about sound. Mm. And there's this arrogance to me that I find troubling coming from casting directors and whatnot, because you know we're in COVID. You know there's only so much we can do by ourselves.
Right.
You can't make your mother, who's a nurse, suddenly know how to deliver lines for a TV show. You know what I mean? She's going to read them and follow punctuation and give you her best.
Right.
And so, and you can't coach that into a person just for your reading. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the ability to not look past that, it bothers me. And I mean, and let me say this last thing. we have spent, as artists, we have spent so much money on headshots and reels and and demos and tapes. And this would be the season to me to really use that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're calling me in for, okay, a cop, I've played countless cops. You mean you can't just look at my reel and be like, well, you know, she'll do a good cop. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so it's this unfortunate thing that happens to actors all the time, and then I'll come up off my soapbox.
No, you're good.
It's this world that never seems to ebb and flow with us. They just expect us to ebb and flow. And even though we do, we make the changes, we switch, and we become better videographers and become better you know, editors and all of this thing. But there is this arrogance that doesn't ever appreciate that I am in a pandemic just like you.
Yes.
And my reader may not be great, but can you take into account my resume where I've done, you know, if it's a play, I've done 30 plays. I've done Shakespeare my whole career. I did Dominique Morisseau's whole canon or August Wilson's whole canon. So maybe I can get through this new play that you're getting ready to do. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it's like, where's the curveball where you realize, oh, they're in a pandemic too. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, we're all in a pandemic. No, I completely understand you and feel you, because I do think it's a little unfair to have such, you know, these expectations when everybody is making these pivots and adjustments, you know, and not being able to just like see what you see and kind of being able to like turn a blind eye to the other stuff, the unforeseen.
I think kind of do their job.
Yeah.
You're a casting director, and then somewhere in there you should be able to make some sort of judgments. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That aren't always like, you should be able to, just like a, you know, a director that says, and this is a big pet peeve of mine. Not that your show is about Tyler's pet peeves.
No.
That's why I need my own podcast called Tyler's Pet Peeves.
It's the Actors Lounge. It's real stuff, so it's fine.
Well, it's just like when you go to, say, you know, nowhere in the union does it say, as actor, I'm talking about theater now, Actors Equity. Mm-hmm. Nowhere in the union does it say we have to be off book for an audition. Nowhere. Chicago actors, again, with that Midwest mentality, we choose to be off book for the choice of being freer, you know, and more able to make choices or whatever. But still, you can still make strong choices if you know how to be familiar and hold your paper. Mm-hmm. But yet, there are some directors in this city, in certain theaters that will remain anonymous, that expect you to come in off book for auditions as well as first day of rehearsal. Mm. You're not paying me for that at all. Mm. And so to ask that of me, to me, seems rather arrogant. Mm. So I don't even look at it as the idea of unfairness as much as I look at the arrogance of it, you know, where you're not willing to do your due diligence and your ability to direct around us learning the part as we perform, but you want us to be already memorized, which to me, any solid actor doesn't want to be memorized like that, because I make choices from what my scene partner says and does. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just this, I never think people give actors, one, they give never give us our just due and what we do, respect for it. And two, we're the only ones, I think, expected to rise to the occasion and be as good as we were before the pandemic.
Yeah.
So that everyone else doesn't have a hiccup in what they do.
Right.
And that I think is, I don't say it's unfair. The world is unfair. I just think it's unacceptable and a bit, you know, arrogant.
Yeah. Mic drop. No, I agree with you 100%. I do. I wanted to ask you, cause I know, you know, you have a large experience with stage and film, TV. Mm-hmm. What have the adjustments, like, was it like a big adjustment when you started doing television and film versus the stage, or what was that process like for you?
Yeah, there were major adjustments, and I'll use the shy primarily because this is the first time I've ever been on something for four seasons. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And with a character that has had tremendous trajectory. Mm-hmm. So normally in the roles, I've been recurring characters in other shows, but it's like you come in, do what you do, say what you say, mm-hmm. and we'll see you the next time. Right. But and your character is always kind of doing the same thing with a few different words. Well, in this one, you know, there's major trajectory. I have tremendous challenges. I have two kids. And so the adjustment for me, and I remember, I'll say the third season, because the third season is when my role escalated to 9 episodes. So I went from 6 to 9 episodes, and I was given the challenge of the emotional journey with my role, right? And so I had to realize a few things that I was slowly picking up in, say, season 1 and 2, which is, one, and you hear this all the time, TV doesn't care about the stuff we care about in theater, right? Mm-hmm. In theater, we want all the dots to meet and T's to be crossed so that we have a full character when we start working, mm-hmm. right? And TV is like, yeah, say the line, hit that mark, and keep it moving, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Do all that homework by yourself. We're not doing any of that on set. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so what I then had to learn is how to make that adjustment for myself, right? Mm-hmm. Like how to, and also in theater, we go straight through, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're a recurring character and you're coming in for this specific thing, you do that and you're gone. But for something like this with The Chi, we shoot out of sequence. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if I used last season when Keisha was kidnapped, I had to do one sequence where I had to go see if she was lying in the grass, look at a dead body. Mm. Well, we will shoot the sequence of me crying about that before I ever saw it, you know? Mm. So it's totally out of sequence, and you have to learn how to be out of sequence with your emotions, which you don't have the challenge of.
Yeah.
So that was a big learning curve for me. And these are things I'm doing on my own privately. I'm making notes to myself. And the other thing is you're always working with a lot of movement. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. where you're trying to drop and be in the center of this emotional moment, crew still got to do what crew got to do. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And other characters that aren't working are maybe talking about what they're going to be working on. And so everything, there's a lot of moving pieces, I guess is what I'm saying. And you've got to learn how inside of all of that movement and activity to center and be able to go there where you need to go when they say, you ready, Tyler? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the last thing I really thought was, wow, this is really something, is we get to rehearse. You know, in theater, you rehearse over and over and over and over again. And when you're only a recurring character here or there, you come in, you rehearse, you do it, you're gone. But in this situation, you're trying to connect all the dots and keep the through line for the character. And you literally come in, you rehearse it so that they can decide on lighting and placement and mm-hmm. shots. And then it's like, okay, team two, you go sit down, we'll call you back, we're ready to shoot it. So you're like, the funny part about that is, of course, you know, you're an actor. The minute you finish it, you're like, damn, if I'd had one more rehearsal, mm-hmm. I would have did that a little differently.
Yeah.
So what I started doing to train myself is, you know, there's always a team too, so you have a stand-in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, and I have wonderful people that are stand-ins for The Chi, and the young lady that often stands in for me is Takara.
Mm-hmm.
And Takara, I would say, I'm going to sit through it. I'm just going to sit while they're setting the lights and all that, because it gives me a chance to be in this space, to get familiar with the space, to sit in the room, to think the thoughts, or, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I had to learn how to do that by myself, so that I could feel strong in the choice that I made when we started filming. So that I didn't walk away filming like, oh man, now I know what choice I wanted to make, but I was nervous and it was so fast. So those are the kind of things that I learned on my feet, and I'm really grateful for them, because it is a different beast, and it's a beautiful experience to have. I admit that, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that is so, like, that's very eye-opening, especially for, you know, people who've never had that experience of, like, actually working on a television show or, you know, a set with all those moving parts. It's just a lot of pressure. And, you know, you're expected to just be ready and go. And so I love the fact that you're, you know, saying, like, you had to do this for yourself. Like, you had to kind of figure out, okay, what's my process? Like, how can I make this work for me? You know, because nobody's, like, pulling you aside, like, okay, this is what you do. You know, it's like, you're expected to come in, hit your mark, do your, you know, do your thing, and on to the next. So it's so interesting, because I feel like that is such a pressurous situation. You know, you got to be ready. You got to be on. So,
well, you know what it is. And don't get me wrong, there are directors there to be like, oh, Tyler, can you know, can you look at it this way or whatever?
Yeah.
So it's not that some they're leaving you totally out in the cold by yourself.
Right.
But the majority of your choice must be in place, and that director is really going to tweak for you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's not, they're not getting ready to help you find it. They're just going to tweak what's reading for them after they've shot it and they've seen it, you know, and they're like, well, could we, you know, then they give you a little tweaking thing and you're like, ah, and sometimes it's the perfect little tweak.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, the perfect little thing that you, you know, something registers and you're like, okay, I got it. You know, I know what to do.
Right.
So it is this learning on your feet, and, and no one is looking at you with this side eye. But as actors, you know, we come through the door with pressure on our shoulders because we've already learned through our whole career, whatever your drama is, leave it outside.
Mm-hmm.
Time is money, right? You know, and you want, even if you've never done television before, I remember the first time I did television, I had no idea about hitting my mark or you know, where the hell is the camera? You know, but over time, you learn those things because nobody's telling you. And even if you take a class, there's nothing like real world experience, right?
Very true.
And so you land on those sets. And fortunately, by the time I got to the shot, I knew these sorts of things. But I do remember my first time ever doing television. And I was like, you know, I was trying to like make sure I hit the mark. And I have a habit of leaning on my left leg, on my left side. Mm-hmm. And then they'd be like, okay, well, Tyler, you keep stepping out of frame. And I'm thinking, I'm not even moving.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to pay close attention to why does this cameraman keep saying I'm going out of frame? And that's what it was. So they had lined it up so that the camera hit me in a certain spot so that if I dropped on my left leg, now I'm being blocked by my scene partner. I was like, oh, that's what it is. So I got to stay on this. But, you know, so it was those little things that you're like, nobody told me that.
Yeah.
You know?
Seems like it's like. It's just, you can take a class, but it's one thing to, like, experience it and have your own experience.
Exactly. And so it's always a learning curve. I say to any actor, don't be ashamed of the fact that you're in the learning curve. Mm. You're graduating from the next level, your career, to the next. And just like any graduation from, you know, kindergarten to grade school to grammar to high to college to PhD, whatever, you have something to learn in that graduation. So don't walk through the door thinking you know it all. Don't walk through the door thinking you're 100% ready. Mm-hmm. Walk through the door open and ready to learn and graduate to this next level. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, that is great advice. Oh, thank you for saying that. That's so good.
You're welcome.
Because it's just like you said, like that pressure, you know, and feeling like, oh, I gotta, you know, come off this way or I should know this. And it's like, no, we all have our learning curves and you're always going to be learning. And it's better to just be open and, you know, be at a place that you can be coachable or you could be directed. So,
And pay attention. Just pay attention. Don't get on the set and be so caught up in like, oh my God, I'm here. Mm-hmm. I've arrived. No, you're on there. You got to be like, I am going to be learning. And you don't just learn from your fellow actors. You do learn from the cameraman. You do learn from the DP. You do learn from the, you know, I still to this day am fascinated by all the people that contribute to making one shot happen, let alone a whole show. You know what I mean? I sat recently and talked to the script supervisor for The Shy. I wanted to know, I've seen her, I'd watched her for the last you know, a couple of years. And I her name is Schooley. Well, we call her Schooley. That's her last name, so we just call her Schooley. Mm-hmm. But I've watched it, her for the 4 years I've been involved with The Chi. And even in other times where I've worked on other shows, and I asked her, Schooley, what all do you do? Mm. You know, and she explained, excuse me, that as a script supervisor, which sounds obvious now when I say this, script supervisor, you think, oh, she's just there to make sure our lines are correct, right? You say your line, or she comes up and she's like, okay, well, no, it's supposed to be like this. Mm-hmm. But no, she literally is writing down the camera angles. She's writing down the shots. And so that if when we go back to it, if it's a little off, she comes out and she can say, you know, this was here, this was there. Mm-hmm. And so she literally is writing that everything that happens on the script, I mean, in the shooting, onto the script. Mm. So it's so much more than just worrying about actors and the lack of them knowing their lines properly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I never stop watching and learning from what people are doing and how they're contributing, and really appreciating all those other sides of it that help us to make TV shows and movies and in theater as well, you know?
Yeah, it's magic. It is amazing.
It is. It's a lot of hands in that, making that pot of stew. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows about most of the hands. They just know about the stew. You know, primarily the actor, the writer, director. Right. That's what we know about.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. No, that's so, so true. What would you say, just from your experience looking back, like what would you say are a few things that an actor should always be doing to get better at their craft or just to increase their chances of, you know, booking work?
Good question. Let me think about that. Okay. I think an actor should always, first of all, you should always be learning. Like, you are never finished learning your craft. If you can't afford a class, then you should be watching the films of your favorite actors because you are learning from them, right? Mm-hmm. Something as simple as watching Viola Davis and thinking, why did she make that choice? Mm-hmm. Is teaching yourself something. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because everything she's doing on camera is a choice that she's making. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's no such thing as there's no time to learn. If you're not learning from watching your favorite shows or films, you should be learning by watching people. Mm-hmm. Something is, now this is going to sound kind of morbid, but even something as tragic mm-hmm. as a loss or as amazing as a childbirth, you should be sitting there like, this is how people look when they are happy. I remember when my mom passed and, you know, you're having this grief and you think, this is how it feels. Like, this is what it feels like. It sounds crazy, but actors have those kind of out-of-body experiences all the time where you're registering what grief feels like because you're always, so in essence, that's just one. You should always be learning from every aspect of your life. Number two, I believe that you set a goal. Like, I just mentored this young lady maybe a couple weeks ago, and I was saying to her, if you want William Morris as your agent, that's fine. Put it on your goal sheet. You may not get them now because you're just starting out. You're a beginner. You they don't even know you exist. You don't know what you're going to do to get through their door. But it doesn't mean it isn't on your goal sheet. Put the five that you want on your goal sheet, Riz. I want to work with these five directors. I want to work with these five. I want to be represented by one of these five agencies. And you put them there, and so you've got a clear line to a goal.
Yeah.
Where I am, where I'm going. Mm-hmm. Instead of it being this murky, blurry kind of, decide.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You might say, I want to move to LA one day. That's fine. It's a goal, but it doesn't have to be today. It doesn't have to be tomorrow. But you can make it a part of, you can make it definitive so that you have a direction.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that in 2 years investment, you say, you know what? I don't want to go to LA. I want to move to New York.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But as long as you are keeping clear to yourself
right.
what your goals are, you can you have a direction to drive your force of energy.
Yeah.
And you are the force of energy.
Right.
But if you have no direction to drive your force of energy, you'll find yourself just moving through the space, having experiences you don't want to have, sitting around waiting on, you know, why isn't anybody calling me? Mm-hmm. None of that.
Yes.
And this is the most important thing, I think. And a gentleman told me this that I was dating years and years ago. And I was going on about being an actor and not getting a call from my agent, blah, blah, blah. And he was a successful businessman. So I always give this example to everybody. I thought it was super important to me. So number three is, he said to me, while I was complaining, how much do you pay your agent? And he had nothing to do with the business. I said, well, they make 10% of everything I make. And he said, okay, well, then that means you make 90. So if you do 90% of the work and they do 10. So if they make a phone call, they've done their 10. What did you do in your 90? And I was like,
slap you right in the face. It's like, okay.
With reality. Yeah. So my point in that, the way I processed that, and let me just say, he went on further to say, when I started my business, it was just me. He started from his university. I was just me in school with an idea. When I finished, it was me at home in my little studio apartment. Then it was me with a roommate, and I did the mail, I answered the phones, I did this. It took years for my company to grow and to build. But you have to see yourself as your own company.
Yeah.
You are an independent contractor at all times. Mm-hmm. And as an independent contractor, you might have to drop the mail, you may have to answer the phones, you might have to wait the table, mm-hmm. but what is your real business? Mm-hmm. This is your business. All that other stuff is just what you do to maintain your business.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I was just like, it reinvented the way I thought about myself and my career.
Yeah.
It really reinvented it.
Wow.
And so I never saw my ages as somebody that works for me anymore. I saw people that I was in a partnership with, right? Because they only get 10%.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with 10%, you're not even putting ink in the printers. You know what I mean?
Right.
You're not keeping the lights on with 10%.
Yeah.
If you made $1,000 on the episode, you only paid them $100.
Mm.
How much you going to do for $100? You know what I'm saying?
That's so true right there.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you make $100,000 and you made them 10, they might remember your birthday.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right,
so,
right.
So it becomes a way of looking at it and seeing yourself as a business, mm-hmm. always working and learning and always being willing to be, you know, goal setting
mm-hmm.
so that you know a direction that you're headed.
Yes.
And that way people and naysayers and family members who can't see it happening or don't believe in you or friends who hit before you did, that becomes just part of the life. It's not anything against you. It's not personal.
Yeah.
Your goal is the present and you're going for those goals, not other people's goals.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
That makes sense?
That's so empowering. Cool. That perspective shift, that's everything. That puts the power back into your hands. Like
always, keep it in your hands.
Yeah, keep it in your hands and not feeling like, oh, they're supposed to be doing this for me. It's like, no, what are you doing for yourself? Like, how are you
exactly.
steering this boat? Yes, I love that. That is so good.
Yeah, and I believe in that because I am an actor advocate, and I believe that actors are definitely the first that people want to intimidate and bully. And I welcome actors to stay empowered and stay active in your career. And you've already decided to be an artist, period. So you may as well continue in your fearlessness.
Right.
No point in becoming afraid now.
Yeah.
You know, you decided to be an actor. You've already jumped.
Yeah.
You may as well see how high you can fly, you
wow.
know?
Have you always been like this or has this like developed over, you know, your journey as an actor, artist?
Over my journey. Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's why when I do mentor young actors, I know they feel like, Tyler, you feel like you're in my brain.
Yeah.
You want to know why? Because I have already been there.
Yeah.
But one of the things I promised myself as I was on my own journey is I made sure to note the things I didn't want anyone else to feel. Like I would say, I'll never make someone feel like that, right? So the people who came to me that were like, you know, I remember when I said I was going to be an actor and someone very close to me said, so what that mean, you're going to wait tables? that was, oh, that broke my heart, you know. Yeah. Not that waiting tables is a, but that just already told me that they didn't even think I could do it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Another associate of mine that was close to me, friend, was like, you know what? Why don't you do porno? You know, that's what you equated my asking to, like, I should just do porno.
Gosh.
And people who did not believe in you, or family members who you can't pay to come see a play, but they will brag about you being in a infomercial. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so over time, it's like when I started to become empowered, and like I said, I met that gentleman that said something I needed.
Yeah.
I took information from people who were lights, who gave me little jewels, and I told myself, pay that forward. You got to give that jewel to somebody else at some point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so you don't always have to give, you don't always pay forward some extra money or some, you know, a room to stay in your house. You can pay forward a jewel that you're like, I learned this right when I was your age and right when I was in your career position and right when I was shedding the same tears over the same thing. Let me give you this little jewel.
Yeah.
You know, so it's been years of developing into a person that wants to, one, empower other actors, two, just make sure that they know if you got somebody that don't believe in you, I believe you. Call me.
Yes.
Call me. I'll put you on point.
Yes, I feel the energy. I love it. Like, oh,
you know?
My gosh. Yeah. No, it's appreciated because there are so many, you know, it's like you can speak this because you've been there. That's why.
Yes.
I can feel it so much. I'm like, oh, she's been through some things, so she knows, you know, like you can speak to this audience, speak to myself and encourage us and like be like, no, keep going, be empowered. Like, you
keep
don't have
going.
To feel like you're at the bottom of the barrel and you're never going to make it. It's like, make your goals, be clear about it. And yeah, all that stuff is just so good. Very, very good advice.
And, you know, I always tell, like, this is a big one that people do to actors. And I remember it happening to me a lot. You know, I remember friends, family, people who love you, and they do love you. I understand. Let me say this for the people who are support systems.
Mm-hmm.
In their negativity, some of them, not all of them, they really don't even know they're being negative. They think they're being straight with you. I'm telling you the truth.
Right.
You know, those people whose truths have to be your truths. So they're not all set out to be negative, but when people would come up and say things like, why you not on Girlfriend? Or you should call Oprah. You know, there's an Oprah studio, Harpo Studios was here.
Yeah.
And I would say to them, you know, they work for a major company. Let's just take one out of the air so nobody knows who I'm talking about. Let's say AT&T.
Okay.
Then I would say to them, why don't you just go to the VP of AT&T and tell him you want to be the president of AT&T? Like, since you think it's so easy to just walk in to Oprah and be like, yo, Oprah, you need to put me on, girl.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
It don't work like that.
It does not work like that. But people don't, they don't see that. Or, you know, somebody come up to you and they say, you know what? I don't know how you didn't get on, The Chi. Say you live in Chicago. And somebody's like, girl, you should just go on, you should ask Lena Waithe to let you get on the Chi. And you're just like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to call Lena Waithe and be like, hey, Lena. Can I get on the
side? Like, it's that easy.
Like, it's that easy.
Yeah.
So there's this sense of the people not knowing what we have to go through to just, for what our accomplishments are when we are day player. Mm-hmm. And then we, you know, we get a whole, you know, some lines. We get a guest star, a co-star, guest star. And then, you know, people don't know the roles and the audition, the amount of auditions we've gone through before we get there. And you have... You have people who you get in relationships with, and all of a sudden they like the idea of you being an actor, an artist of some sort, but they don't understand the commitment it takes, right? The dedication it takes.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you're arguing over your career versus your relationship.
Mm.
So it's not unusual for any of us to have the same stories. It's just, what's important is to know that you're not alone and just stay with it.
Right.
It's a weight gain. Just stay with it and you'll come through it. You know what I mean? You'll come out on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Very, very wise words. Very wise words. So I read that you have a love for the Harlem Renaissance time period. Can you
Favorite.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the type of projects you have coming out and, you know, exploring that era?
Well, you know, I it's so funny because this is the journey I think of it as. Mm-hmm. When I was a young girl, I loved mystery novels, mm-hmm. and I would read mystery novels like crazy, and then I stumbled into, you know, I've always wrote poetry myself, and so, you know, in school, you know, I grew up on the West Side, you know, the school I went to was pretty much all Black except for one guy. His name was Jose, but I think he was, other than the teachers, Jose was the only Latin student, and everybody else was Black. Wow. And so, of course, in an all Black environment, you learn all of the civil rights and things like that. And so we would read all these poets, you know, Claude McKay and Langston Hughes, Vernon Hurston. And I thought, oh, they just seem to write my life. But of course, they wrote about the inner city and Harlem and all of these things in the South. And I just felt like, oh man, these people totally know my life, and the rhythms in which the characters spoke felt so real. And so I would write poetry, and reading those authors kind of sent me on this journey. Right. And that from mystery novels sent me to history novels, because, you know, the American Black experience is the greatest history to me. And so I was like, I want to just dissect all of this stuff. And I started at the Harlem Renaissance period, because that's where those writers were. That's where Zora Neale Hurston, I had the dream of going to New York and going to the, you know, speakeasies and, you know, just being a part of that whole culture that they wrote about during the Harlem Renaissance period. And I never stopped being floored by it. And I love the period where the costumes were so, well, not costumes, I call them costumes. The clothes were so beautiful and lavish and elaborate. And I think what history showed me that school was not showing me, and definitely not as I grew up and, you know, started experiencing the world, is that there was this, that we didn't have three eras in our Black experience, which is slavery, civil rights, and Obama. Mm-hmm. We had a tremendous amount of experiences throughout the whole human experience, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was very drawn to the Harlem Renaissance, when we had this era of wealth, right, and affluence, and this education that was, you know, you don't learn about, they spent time on, say, Madam C.J. Walker or W.B. Du Bois. Mm-hmm. But you didn't learn about the period in which they were living. You just kind of learned their stories. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I found in dissecting the period they lived in just so fascinating. And I just wanted to be a part of it. Yeah. And I've never gotten over that love of the Harlem Renaissance. And that's my favorite period in literature.
That's amazing. Yeah, you know, that's so true. Yeah. How you said, we hear about like Madam C.J. Walker, W.E.B. Du Bois, but we don't hear about that time period. Like that was like the norm, you know?
Exactly. And it was when, you know, because we were all so discriminated against at the same level, there was no like, I'm wealthy, you treat me better. It didn't matter, you know? The groups mingled and mixed together. So you had the jazz musicians with the writers, and the writers with the politicians and the educators. And so they all kind of mixed and mingled together. And yes, there was, of course, the, you know, people who were the poorer class that didn't have any money and didn't have education, mm-hmm. but they were still mixed in with these other groups of people, because we all had to mix together. Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I have always just found it so fascinating. And of course, being an actor, I always love the glamour of the clothes. And as an actor, I've always been, you know, not able to be in those clothes, because unless I was playing a white character thrown Black skin, I really, you know, they don't put a, you know, we don't get those Victorian era shows,
right.
You know?
Right.
And so it became important to me to even write a story based in that period, you know?
Yeah. Can you tell us about Relentless?
Yes, of course. with joy, I can tell you about Relentless, which we are talking about getting it up on his feet and doing it. So I'm really excited about that because it's been, you know, of course, pandemic pushed it right, like everything else, to the back. So Relentless was born out of that, one, that love of the Harlem Renaissance, and two, truthfully, the fight of it came, I kind of been nurturing the idea for a while, but I literally was being fitted for a play, and I admired some of the renderings that were on the wall by this other, I was in working in repertory. So the play coming after mine, their renderings were on the wall. And they were these beautiful Victorian costumes by this famous designer, Virgil Johnson. And I loved them. I said, oh, my God, you know, these costumes are so gorgeous. I've always wanted to be able to be in a person that wore these costumes in my career as an actor. And the white girl that was draping me was like, oh, yeah, but you weren't around then. Which blew my mind. Like, what the hell? And I said, what do you mean I wasn't around it? And she goes, oh, you're right. I remember the movie, the series Deadwood, and it was his doctor and his wife. So yeah, you were. And I just thought, my God, the idea that you would actually think black people weren't around in the, you know, 1920s or, you know, late 1800s. And so,
that's so weird.
When I was... I know. So when I was given this, I was given a fellowship, and I started working on creating this play. That was kind of the first thing that came to my mind, to work on the Harlem Renaissance. And so Relentless deals with these Black Victorians, affluent Black folk in 1919. Now, the pandemic has happened, but I wrote my play in 1918. In 2018. So I had no concept that I would be literally living everything the people in my play were kind of up against. Mm-hmm. And even though I don't make it about the pandemic, several of the same things were taking place. We had unrest in 1919 because of the Red Summer that happened here in Chicago. I don't know if you know about Red Summer.
I've heard of that. I don't know exactly about it.
Well, Red Summer is one that that everyone should know about because it was the worst race riot America has seen. In that, in 1919, on the Lake Michigan, you had, of course, blacks couldn't cross certain sides of the, you know, this side was for blacks, this was for whites. Well, after graduation, this young black boy was on a tire drifting out into the water, and he fell asleep, and he slipped off the tire into the water. And when blacks went to try to save him, the white officer wouldn't let them cross into the white side of the lake. And so he drowned. And that started this race riot of blacks being like, you know, no more. We're not going to take it anymore. And it went on, and it went from Chicago to Boston and showed itself in many parts of the country where this just unfolded constantly for several days, right? Mm-hmm. And the casualties were great, of course, and so it's noted as one of the worst riots ever.
Wow.
And in fact, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote this whole piece on it. So that took place, which in my play is a backdrop. The play isn't about that. It's just like Yours and My Life had the pandemic and the political schemes, political backdrop taking place. We were living our lives, but these are the things we were living with. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay.
So these characters are dealing with unrest. They're dealing with a certain political climate. They're dealing with their own sense of what do I do? How do I get involved? And where does my anger go now? Because I am fed up, right? And at the same time, they're dealing with at that time, it was the influenza virus, also known as the Spanish flu, which we were currently dealing with the pandemic. So
yeah.
It's very much a mirror image of what went on today, even though I wrote my play in 2018.
That's crazy.
And it's very much about how these Victorians, the suffragette movement was taking place. So black women were very instrumental in getting the right to vote. women's right to vote, although they were always put in the background, as we often are, even today, the women's movement today, Black women are always asked to be on the back, the back side of that. The Me Too movement started by a Black woman, and yet it the face of it has always been white women.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so true.
Mm-hmm. And so there is this constant pushing Black women in the back of the line, even though without them, a lot of change does not occur. Mm-hmm. And we know that just, you know, thinking about the, you know, George Floyd and all
right.
of this. So, it, you know, that basically is mirroring relentless to today,
okay.
is that the title stands for that fact, which is systemic racism, violence against Blacks, injustice, is relentless. And we should not be 100 years from today in a fist fight for our justice.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's basically what, you know, to put it up, you know, so that you realize how current it is and yet how beautiful it is, because you have this 1920s era of all of these beautiful costumes. Like I said, they're affluent. You're not going to see the Black people that we're used to seeing where they don't have, you know, they have very little. No, these were the people that were the movers and shakers of that time. And believe it or not, it was the Depression that destroyed a lot of the progress that they made, you know? So I hope that answers that, but it's not too much.
No, it sounds very powerful. And did you find that you changed any bit of the story at all because of the pandemic, or did you make any?
No.
No. Okay.
I haven't touched the play.
Oh,
it
wow.
is, it is, it is, I personally, you know, it's my play. So of course I'm going to say this, but I feel like it's in perfect order. I was not trying to do 2020s. I had no idea. None of us had any idea in 2019 we would lose a whole year to a pandemic. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Of course we couldn't have anticipated the movement that the George Floyd's murder sparked. Because we've had Black men die in the streets for, you know, forever.
Right.
And we've been in protests. And, I mean, you know, it's not like it's gone unscreamed about.
Right.
But what happened with George Floyd was just, you know, a whole nother level of a movement. And I applaud young people like yourself and others for that. But so I didn't feel a need to change it because it wasn't written to be that kind. It wasn't written to be a pandemic play. It was it's a play about Black Victorians.
So
I just found it beautifully prolific that it was so a mirror image of today. It was almost like me in the theater, Timeline Theater, that's producing it, was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like every time we'd see something on the news, we'd be on the phone like, you put this in this is in the play, you know, like,
that's crazy.
All I can say is it was just, you know, it was my gift. It was the gift given to me to write, and I was just a vessel for it.
Wow.
That's so powerful. Yeah.
Wow. That's powerful. So you're an actor, writer, director. Have you worn all three hats, like on any specific project, or do you prefer to, you know, be an actor and just focus on acting, or be a director, focus on, or, you know what I mean? Like, do you like to mix them all?
I do.
Oh, okay.
And I do. No, I do understand what you mean.
Yeah.
I know people who have done it, and I don't know that I want to ever do that. And I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
Even writing my own play, my characters have attitudes and thoughts that are out of my head. I wrote it. But I don't want to play in my own play. And even some, you know, a couple of people that you know, worked with me while we were casting and things like that were like, you don't want to play one of these roles. And I was like, even though I would want this role, if I was an actor and it came across my desk, I'd be like, oh my God, I got to get in this play. No, I want to watch it.
Yeah.
And then as an actor, I have been an actor writer where I had a one woman show I've done. I've performed it, and there is nothing more overwhelming than being on stage all by yourself.
Yeah.
It sounds great, until you are out there. And if you go up, you got to survive. Mm. And there's, you know, there's nobody to pass the ball to. It's just you. That's a lot of pressure, honey. I don't need to do that for 45 minutes. And people who do 2 hour one-woman shows is like, the hell is wrong with you? No. I don't think a one-person show should be more than 70 minutes. It shouldn't go past 60, but if you must, don't go past 70.
Yeah.
And then the idea of directing myself. I am, you know what, I respect the position of the director. I do not want to be on stage and in the house. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So I need that eye to tell me either one, to go further, two, to pull back, or three, that's it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I got a play that I'm directing that's coming up, and I look forward to putting that hat on and being in that role. Okay. The beauty is, because I am an actor and I am a writer, I can usually understand the spaces my actors are in, right? You know, and I always say to even friends who are directors, they'll get it. Mm. It just, everybody's got their own process.
Yeah.
But when I'm on stage with other actors that they ain't on their shit, I'd be mad. I'd be like, when they gonna get on their shit, you know? So it's, you know, no, I prefer to wear the hat separately.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. That makes sense. So I know season 4 of The Chi is premiering, and I was gonna say in May. We are in May.
I know, right? It's going fast.
Because I just wanted to, you know, wrap it up with just asking upcoming projects, you know, anything you want to talk about. So, yeah, I'll give you space to do that.
Yes. The Chi drops on May 23rd. Mm-hmm. Season 4 is going to be, I think, an exciting ride for everybody. I'm looking forward to it. And we'll be shooting at the same time that we are airing, which is a different space for us. Usually we finish and then we can sit and watch at the same time you guys do. But we will still be working not much further after it drops, but we will be working. So look forward to that. I start rehearsal of a play that I'm directing in this summer called The Last Pair of Earlies, written by Joshua Allen, who was he's a writer as well, but he was a writer on PR. Not PR, what was it called? Empire. And so I'm looking forward to directing that piece at Raven Theater on the North Side here in Chicago. Nice. And then my own play, Relentless. We're looking to, you know, we're starting to talk about when we're going to get that on its feet and up and running between the end of this year and the beginning of next year. So those are my next. I got a couple other projects, but I don't know where they are yet. So I'm not going to mention them until I absolutely know.
Yeah.
TV projects. So, yeah. So that's awesome. What's coming.
Awesome. Well, can you let listeners know where they can find you, keep up with you on social media?
Yes. You can keep up with me at Tyler Abercrombie on the gram. And please do. I am constantly learning how to use the gram. So be patient with me. on Facebook, I have a name I write under. And so it's Shelby Cross, the name Shelby and the name and the word Cross.
Okay.
So please feel free. I usually post the same thing on both pages, so you're not missing out on anything.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Nice. Thank you so much. This has been a pleasure just talking to you. You have like a wealth of knowledge. You have such a great spirit and energy. So this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the Actors Lounge.
Thank you so much. And I hope that, you know, somebody listening finds some kind of light in what I've said and that it that they can use it. And if not, pass it on to someone who can.
Absolutely. Well, you have a good rest of your day and I will talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mel.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.